Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Tuesday, the 7th of May. Hamas says it accepts the latest Gaza ceasefire deal, prompting celebrations in the Palestinian territory. Israel, though, says it can't agree to the proposal, but is willing to negotiate. Meanwhile, thousands of Palestinians are evacuating part of Rafah as Israel carries out what it calls targeted strikes. Also in the podcast, Russia announces drills involving tactical nuclear weapons near Ukraine. The authorities in South Africa search for survivors trapped in a collapsed building. And
it's a really big day for Boeing. They've been working on Starliner for 10 years at least. This is the big one. This is the first test flight with humans on board.
All eyes are on Cape Canaveral in Florida, where Boeing is trying to send astronauts into space. After on-off negotiations over the weekend, events in Gaza have moved quickly over the past 24 hours. First, Israel told around 100,000 Palestinians to leave eastern Rafah ahead of a planned offensive on the city. Then the Israeli military began carrying out airstrikes, hitting what it said were more than 50 terror targets. And while all that was going on, Hamas announced it had accepted the latest Egyptian and Qatari proposals for a ceasefire and hostage deal. That news prompted an outpouring of joy in Rafah. The BBC's Gaza correspondent Rushdie Abu Alouf has been monitoring events from Istanbul.
I think Hamas' quick response today was part of the Israeli plan to launch big ground operation in Rafah, which already started this morning. Well, there is no movement of tank yet. Within Rafah itself, yeah, there is some tanks in the border, very heavy artillery shell in the eastern part and heavy airstrike in the area. We have seen throughout the day people are leaving to the western part of the city. And what Hamas said in the end, now the ball is in the hand of the Israelis to decide whether they accept the deal.
Our Gaza correspondent, Rushdie Abu Alouf. Israel initially said the draft deal included far-reaching changes it could not accept. But a few hours later, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that while he didn't like the proposal, he would send negotiators to try to reach an agreement. At the same time, he said Israel would continue its attacks in Rafah. The Israeli army spokesman is Daniel Hagari.
Throughout the day, Air Force aircrafts targeted more than 50 terror targets in the Rafah area. This evening as well, we call on those who are in specific areas, which we have designated and defined in all ways, including radio, media, internet, and flyers in eastern Rafah, to move towards the expanded humanitarian zone in Al-Mawasi and Khan Yunis. There they will get full humanitarian assistance.
Israeli Army spokesman Daniel Hagari. Israeli protesters took to the streets outside Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office, demanding that he accept a deal to get the hostages out.
I think that our government is not willing to cease fire, and that's why I'm so worried.
We should say, yes, let's sit and talk and do anything we can do to bring the hostages home. We call our government to accept this.
Crazy government wants to enter Rafah. It wants to continue the war instead, and which will not bring any peace. It will kill more Palestinian civilians, of course. It will kill our soldiers, and it will kill our hostages.
Well, just before we recorded this podcast, I spoke to our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, in Jerusalem, and I asked him if he'd been able to find out what is in the proposed deal.
We've got a rough idea, yes. It's a two-phase deal that would consist of the first phase as a 42-day truce, a period of no fighting, during which there would be an exchange of prisoners. 33 hostages let out of Gaza, primarily women, the elderly and the sick, in return for a much, much larger number of Palestinian prisoners to be let out of Israeli jails. A large number of Palestinian displaced people who are currently sheltering in the south would be allowed to return to their homes in the north of Gaza, and there would be a phased dismantling of Israel's military operation in central Gaza and a gradual withdrawal of its forces. This will be followed by a similar period of hopefully calm, leading to, quote, a sustained period of calm. So this is the kind of mealy-mouthed way of trying to get around Hamas's insistence on an end to the fighting. The reason why the talks collapsed in Cairo the weekend was that Hamas insisted that they wouldn't sign up to anything that didn't promise a total end to Israel's assault on Gaza. And the Israeli government said, no way are we going to agree to that. Now, we still don't know exactly what Israel is going to agree to. I think they've been, frankly, a bit blindsided by this. They began the day, as we know, with dropping leaflets on the residents of eastern Rafah in southern Gaza Strip, telling them to evacuate because a limited military operation was underway or about to start. And that has started. So what we've had in the last few hours is an announcement that there has been a unanimous war cabinet decision here in Israel to continue to prosecute their military operation in Rafah, but at the same time they will be sending a delegation of negotiators to Cairo to try and thrash out a deal with Hamas. They've said that the terms of the deal at the present are far from what meets Israel's needs, but they are prepared to go the extra mile to try and thrash it out. So I think we're in a more optimistic place than we were 24 hours ago.
Yeah, and the fact that they have agreed to send negotiators is significant. At the weekend, they wouldn't do that. Does this suggest that Benjamin Netanyahu is coming under pressure from the US and others?
He's under pressure from all sides. So he's got the Americans say, do the deal. Don't do a military operation in Rafah. Do the deal instead. And he has kind of gone against their wishes by launching this military operation in Rafah. Although I'm sure there'll be some elements of the military security establishment here in Israel who will be congratulating themselves by saying, look, we've started to put military pressure on them in Rafah, and look what happens. They agree to a deal. We need to continue with the operation. There are, of course, the hostage families who've been out protesting tonight, as they have been most nights, particularly in Tel Aviv, demanding in Hebrew, Exarch Shav, deal now. They want Israel to do a deal and to stop prevaricating and get on with it to get their hostages out.
Frank Gardner in Jerusalem. Well, the prospect of an Israeli invasion of Rafah has prompted warnings from a number of countries. The UN said a safe evacuation from the city would be impossible after Israel told Palestinians to move to two tented cities. One of those instructed to leave Rafah is 21-year-old student Mahmoud Rostom.
For more than 2 weeks, the IDF are posting on the Arabic channels and social media that they will enter Rafah soon. So we did that because we are afraid of a near operation here in Rafah. We are suffering here and we need to do that every day. It's unknown future. We don't know when the war will stop.
Well, Scott Anderson is the Gaza director for the main UN agency for the Palestinians. He told us about the situation in Rafah and what Palestinians could expect if they had to move to the tent city of Al-Mawasi.
They're very crowded already. There's almost 500,000 people that had previously been displaced and had decided to literally set up camp in Al-Mawasi. So it's a very difficult place to find additional space for people to set up their tents. Over 6,000 people so far have left Rafah, headed toward Khan Yunis or the middle area. I think people are quite nervous that they won't find somewhere good to set up their tent, or that if they wait, they won't be able to take their tent with them. And they just want to find somewhere that they can set up and try to find the basic necessities for their families every day. I certainly don't see evidence of supplies coming from anybody other than the international humanitarian community. There's still 1.4 million people in Rafah, and we expect up to 1 million people to possibly be displaced from Rafah.
Scott Anderson of UNRWA. Well, the US is anxious that Israel doesn't carry out its planned major military operation on the city, as our North America correspondent Gary O'Donoghue told us.
The administration here believing we're at a really critical stage. in this whole process. They are saying that they're looking at the details of the deal that Hamas have said they'll accept, talking to their partners in the region. And also, of course, the CIA director, Bill Burns, is shuttling between Qatar and Cairo, trying to work out what to do next. Now, they're saying that they're going to look at that in great detail. One thing they're being very clear on is the question of Rafah. They say they've seen no credible plan of how to protect humanitarian needs in Rafah if there were any kind of incursion there. They've been opposed to that all along. And I think one thing today from the National Security Council spokesman John Kirby sums it out. He said, "I don't think there has been a more sensitive stage than right now."
Gary O'Donoghue, our North America correspondent. Other news now, and a major operation involving police, sniffer dogs and emergency services is underway to try to find dozens of people trapped under the rubble of a collapsed multi-storey building in the South African city of George. Two people are confirmed dead, while more than 20 survivors with varying injuries have been taken to nearby hospitals. From Johannesburg, here's Shingai Nyoka.
The dead were among the first group of injured construction workers ferried to the hospital after the building collapsed. A George City spokeswoman confirmed that 75 crew members were on site when the five-story apartment structure crashed on Monday afternoon. CCTV footage showed the moment that the building collapsed in a cloud of dust. A major operation is underway to find those still trapped. The volunteer group Gift of the Givers, which is providing on-site assistance, told the AFP that rescuers had established communication with some of those still under the rubble.
Shingai Nyoka in South Africa. The French President Emmanuel Macron has thanked his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping for a fresh commitment not to sell arms to Russia. President Xi, who is in Paris on his first state visit to Europe in 5 years, also came under pressure over trade. The president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, said there were imbalances between China and the EU that were a matter of great concern. Our correspondent in Paris, Andrew Harding, has the details.
A formal French welcome for China's President Xi Jinping. But France, and indeed the European Union, are starting to take a much tougher line with China, a country they now see on many levels as more of a rival than a partner. In Paris, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen made some pointed remarks about the need for tough decisions to protect Europe's economy and security. There is growing concern that China is flouting international rules and flooding Europe with heavily subsidised goods like electric cars. President Emmanuel Macron, often keener to charm than to chastise, has also begun taking a tougher line on the war in Ukraine and on China's enduringly close relationship with Russia.
Merci beaucoup.
In a statement after their meeting,
nous accueillons favorablement,
Mr. Macron said he was pleased that President Xi had vowed not to sell weapons to Russia and to control strictly the export of dual-use goods that could be used for military purposes. But Mr. Macron noted that the Chinese had made a similar promise a year ago. There is open scepticism here about China's global intentions and concern about the extent to which Beijing seeks to weaken ties within the European Union and between Europe and the United States.
Andrew Harding in Paris. Our China media analyst Carrie Allen told me more about how Xi Jinping's visit is going down back home.
There's been a lot of fanfare about this trip. So state media have very much wanted to make an emphasis that it's been 60 years since China and France established diplomatic ties, and that France is actually the biggest major Western country that's had ties this long with China. So they're saying that there's a very important relationship between China and France. That's been the emphasis more than anything, that that visiting Europe is a positive thing, being able to establish trade as part of initiatives like the Belt and Road is very important to China. But more than anything, there's been a real emphasis on this relationship between China and France, and a lot of messaging saying that the two countries are friends and that there's the potential for them to establish wider collaboration deals. There's a big focus on trade.
Do they actually talk about the disputes that the two sides are having, or merely trade as a whole?
Not at all. No, what's interesting is there's no mention of the dispute whatsoever. Instead, I think there's a climate in China where state media often paint the West in general as the bad guy. So any kind of negative reporting may actually ruffle feathers. But because China recognises that France is an important market to China and vice versa, sector. I mean, for example, luxury fashion in China is very, very important to France. It doesn't want to ruffle feathers at this time while these talks are taking place. It does recognise that there are benefits to really playing up the emphasis on two friendly nations meeting.
And what about the other issue at the heart of these talks, the war in Ukraine and China's supposed support for Russia?
There has been mention of this. There's very much been a message that China and France, as two large nations, that there is the potential for the two of them to work together more closely and to bring stability to warring nations. I mentioned warring nations because not just the situation with Ukraine, there's also a lot of reference to what's happening in Gaza at the moment. And a view that comes out in China is that France, very much like China, would like to achieve a ceasefire. So there's a hope that the two countries can align in that way and promote that messaging.
Our China media analyst, Carrie Allen. Since the start of its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Russia has repeatedly invoked the threat of nuclear war to try to stop Western nations supporting the Ukrainians. Now the Russians say they are planning to hold drills involving tactical nuclear weapons near Ukraine in response to, quote, threats by France and the UK. The Russian Foreign Ministry summoned both the French and British ambassadors in Moscow to discuss recent statements by President Macron and the British Foreign Secretary David Cameron. NATO has called Russia's threat of nuclear exercises dangerous and irresponsible. Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, is following developments.
Russia's Ministry of Defence said the planned drills would increase the readiness of its non-strategic nuclear forces. Short-range tactical nuclear weapons are less powerful than strategic ones, but could nevertheless devastate large areas. Some can deliver many times the yield of the nuclear bomb the US dropped on Hiroshima in 1945. Moscow's been angered in part by recent comments from President Emmanuel Macron. To the consternation of some allies, he's refused to rule out potentially deploying French troops were Kiev to request that, referencing a need for strategic ambiguity. Moscow also denounced remarks last week from Britain's Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, which appeared to suggest Kiev would be free to use British-made weapons on targets inside Russia. President Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has responded.
This is a completely new round of escalation of tension. It's unprecedented. Of course, it requires special attention and special measures.
The foreign ministry in Moscow said it hoped the nuclear drills would cool, as it put it, the hotheads in Western capitals. Kiev sees the planned exercises as a continuation of what it calls nuclear blackmail, a sentiment broadly echoed by Estonia's Prime Minister, Kaja Kallas.
Russia has threatened with the nuclear arms before. So far, these have been only threats. Can we tell for certain that he's not going to use them? No, we can't, because they have done all sorts of crazy things before. But we must understand why they are making these threats, to make us refrain from the decisions that we would otherwise make. We shouldn't give in to that.
The rise in tensions comes on the eve of Mr. Putin's re-inauguration as president and ahead of an annual military parade on Red Square on Thursday to mark victory in the Second World War.
Danny Eberhard. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
Welcomed by her host, the Queen joined President Mitterrand in simultaneously cutting a ribbon, officially opening the under-channel link.
Celebrating 30 years since the opening of the Channel Tunnel linking Britain and France. It's clear that Donald Trump is finding it difficult to keep quiet about his criminal trial in New York. As the third week of hearings began, the former US president was fined $1,000 and held in contempt of court for the 10th time. The judge warned him he could end up in jail if he continued violating a gagging order. Meanwhile, the jury has been hearing from a current and a former employee of the Trump organization. Our correspondent, Neda Taufik, has been at the court in Manhattan. So could Mr. Trump really end up in prison?
This was the strongest warning, really, we've had from Judge Juan Merchan, and he acknowledged the implications of jailing a presidential candidate and the security challenges that would come with that, given Donald Trump is a former president with a Secret Service detail. But he said, even though it is something he does not want to do, that he's trying to avoid at all costs, that he has a job to protect the dignity of the judicial system. So he gave Donald Trump a strong warning. But I think it is is worth noting here that the judge has been trying to play this very carefully. He found that Donald Trump was in contempt for making comments about the jury, which he said was a direct attack on the rule of law and put them at risk for safety concerns. But other alleged violations brought up by prosecutors, well, the judge said it was protected political speech potentially, and so didn't fine him for those. So we are seeing the judge trying really hard here to respect Donald Trump's right to a free speech and to avoid giving him jail time while trying to make sure that this process is respected.
Meanwhile, the court has been hearing from witnesses from inside the Trump organization. What's been going on?
Yeah, we've had our 10th witness, Jeffrey McConney. He's a longtime controller of the Trump organization. He's no longer with the organization, but he was there for 35 years. And prosecutors are essentially trying to prove to the jury documents don't lie. They basically introduced with McConney's testimony a series of invoices, ledger entries that they say proves that the Trump organization cooked the books to hide the hush money payment. Now, of course, hush money in itself isn't illegal, but the prosecutors here say that Donald Trump falsified 34 business records to hide election violations. And so McConney says he did meet with Alan Weisselberg, the chief financial officer. He did receive a copy of that wire payment from Michael Cohen to Stormy Daniels' lawyer. And he said that they basically did come up with a way to pay Michael Cohen $35,000 a month over a year, and that he never saw a legal retainer agreement from Michael Cohen. But on cross-examination, he acknowledged that Weisselberg never told him what the reimbursement to Cohen was for.
Neda Taufik outside court. Meanwhile, a few blocks away in New York, the issue of deforestation and how to stop it is high on the agenda at this week's UN Forum on Forests. The study, conducted by 15,000 scientists from around the world, suggests that market-based approaches to forest conservation, like carbon offsets and deforestation-free certification schemes, have largely failed to protect trees or alleviate poverty. Dr. Constance McDermott is the report's lead author.
So if we think just on the surface, what is a major driver of deforestation? Well, increasingly, it's global and urban markets for key commodities like palm oil and soy, and that these commodities are replacing forest cover. But underneath this are some major inequalities in global trade and global economies. So in many countries with high deforestation rates, both governments and communities lack adequate alternatives and the resources to manage land sustainably for their benefit. So market-based approaches not only can't compete economically with global commodity expansion, but they don't address these underlying governance and economic challenges. In fact, indigenous and local communities that are affected by this agricultural expansion lack secure rights to their land and to the forest resources. So even in those cases where they would prefer to defend their current livelihoods, they're not in a strong position to do so. I think we do need a fundamental rethink, but there are also many examples where indigenous and local communities have sustainably managed their forests. Leading examples are Mexico and Nepal, where a lot of forest rights have been handed over to communities in large areas of forest. Many of these examples have been successful. I think if we just paid more attention to what is working, how can we support that? And maybe even prioritizing those cases where the benefits of doing so are captured more effectively locally, rather than thinking that there's some silver bullet that we're going to come up with in New York or Tokyo or London or wherever it might be, then I think that would help enormously.
Dr. Constance McDermott, lead author of the report by the International Union of Forest Research Organizations. As we record this podcast, the first crewed mission of Boeing's Starliner is due to blast off, bound for the International Space Station. The project has suffered delays, but if this launch at Cape Canaveral in Florida is successful, Boeing will become the second private company to take NASA astronauts to the space station after SpaceX. Pallab Ghosh reports.
It's been a long road for Boeing's Starliner to the launch pad. Its first uncrewed test flight in 2019 didn't make it to the space station because a software fault caused the spacecraft's engines to misfire. A second attempt in 2022 did make it, but there were issues with some thrusters and the craft's cooling system. Meanwhile, Boeing's rival, Elon Musk's SpaceX, docked its Dragon spacecraft 4 years ago and has ferried crews and cargo ever since. On Earth, Boeing has been facing growing scrutiny because of faults with some of its aircraft. Dr. Simeon Barber of the Open University says it's important for the company that this test flight goes smoothly.
It's a really big day for Boeing. They've been working on Starliner for 10 years at least. This is the big one. This is the first test flight with humans on board. They've had a few problems on earlier test flights, I think it's fair to say. There's a lot riding on this one.
Boeing's commercial crew program manager, Mark Nappi, said the delays were a normal part of the development of a new spacecraft, and Starliner was now ready to fly with its first crew.
Design and development, it's constant ups and downs, but the overall slope is always up. We're basically at the top of that slope and now starting to get into operations.
Starliner can carry up to 7 astronauts into low Earth orbit, but this time it'll be carrying just 2. During the mission, the astronauts will test their spacesuits and seats and assess onboard life support and navigation systems. On the way back, they'll experience Starliner's landing system, which will touch down on land in the deserts of the southwestern United States. If all goes to plan, Starliner will be certified for regular supply missions to the space station.
Our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh. And from space to undersea travel. 30 years ago, an idea dreamed up in the 17th century became a reality when the Channel Tunnel, linking Britain and France, officially opened. It laid the tracks for the Eurostar train service, which shuttles passengers from London to Paris and beyond, and the Eurotunnel, which carries vehicles and freight. The BBC's Mike Smart reported on the moment when the late Queen Elizabeth officially opened the tunnel in 1994, travelling to meet the then French president in Calais.
Her Majesty's train entered the tunnel at Folkestone to applause from those on board. Emerging half an hour later in France, where the President's train was waiting at the platform in Calais. Safety normally precludes two trains travelling on the same line in opposite directions, but today the French and British locomotives came to rest nose to nose, feet apart. Welcomed by her host, the Queen joined President Mitterrand in simultaneously cutting a ribbon, officially opening the under-channel link.
And that was Mike Smart, my first boss and a former BBC correspondent. Well, our current transport correspondent, Katie Austin, has more details about the anniversary.
Since the Queen made her journey through the Channel Tunnel, 480 million passengers have done the same. These days, 400 trains speed through it each day.
We're now going at about 120 kilometres per hour, which is roughly 75 miles per hour, and we're coming up to the middle of what is still the world's longest undersea tunnel.
Driver Martin has been here since the beginning.
People have this concept that it's just straight through to France, and it's totally not. The tunnel itself is up, down, around the corners and everything. No straight lines at all.
So you sort of know this tunnel like the back of your hand?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's like a second home, really.
Building it was an exceptional feat of engineering.
There are actually three tunnels. The one I'm standing in right now with my high-vis and my hard hat isn't for trains. It's used for ventilation, access for maintenance, and evacuating people in an emergency.
The tunnel carries a quarter of trade between the UK and the EU. Plus plenty of holidaymakers, whether on the Eurostar to Paris and beyond, or using the car shuttle to reach somewhere like Le Touquet, an hour's drive from Eurotunnel's Calais terminal. Tunnel tourists help keep the wheels moving for small businesses, including this one.
I drive the little train. Lots of English people come at the weekend, in cars, in the shuttle. It's very good.
Plenty of Brits swing by the town's golf course.
Every year we got 45,000 visitors, and basically 20,000 of those visitors are English people.
Charles thinks the shorter journey compared to ferries means a longer holiday.
An extra round of golf, so that's more fun for them and more business for us.
The tunnel's financial journey hasn't always been smooth. It opened £2 billion over budget. At one point, the company which runs it nearly went bust. Predicted passenger numbers were never reached, but Eurotunnel became profitable. More recently, new challenges. The pandemic and Brexit meant putting millions into new systems to deal with additional customs rules. Eurotunnel is building an area to cope with the EU's new border system starting this October.
The crossing time will be extended by 5 to maximum 7 minutes for each customers. And as we have extended the number of lanes, there will be no delay on the highway, nothing.
And that report by our transport correspondent, Katie Austin. That is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Isabella Jewell. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Chasing Mountains is the story of five incredible mountaineers competing to become the first woman to climb all 14 of the world's highest mountain peaks, the so-called 8,000ers.
Pitting themselves against nature on the roof of the world.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.